Hello and welcome to the Interior Design Business, the monthly podcast produced by the interior design community for the interior design community. As you may be able to tell, we are recording this episode in front of a live audience of designers gathered today at Decorex 2023. My name is Jeff Hayward, and we're here with a panel of experts to explore interiors and well-being. Health and wellness continue to be top priorities in residential design, according to the American Society of Interior Designers. ACID's 2023 Trends Outlook report identifies a growth towards holistic healthy living and interior design that addresses both the mind and the body. This trend is challenging designers to learn new skills and adapt their design approaches. As part of this evolution, what role does home technology have to play in delivering a comfortable, healthier, and mood-enhancing lifestyle at home? Let's find out with the help of our expert panel for this discussion, BIID award-winning designer Susie Pfeiffer of Pfeiffer Design, Ben Channon of specialist wellbeing design consultancy Ekist, and Damien Smith of leading home technology firm New Wave AV. Welcome to the interior design business. So before we begin, can you each give us a brief introduction to yourself and your business? Damien, do you want to go first on that?
I would love to go first. So I'm Damien from New Wave AV. We're based in Kent and we deal with a variety of projects from small MDUs right up to super prime properties. I also do a lot of work with architects and interior designers in regards to training. Oh, I was on the industry relations board with CEDIA, who's our trade organisation. So doing a lot of work and getting feedback from people like yourselves as to what you're looking for from the world of AV, how we can help you, how we can support you. So that's me.
Great. And Susie, what about you?
Hi, I'm Susie Pfeiffer. I'm the director of Pfeiffer Design, and we run residential interior architecture and design projects. So most of our clients are the end user, the homeowner. So our projects tend to be really individual, really personable. We're very privileged last year to win an award for our design studio. We use it as not only a place to work, but a place that really resonates with our design standards, and it stands as a testament to who we are.
Wonderful. And Ben?
I'm Ben. I trained as an architect, actually. I worked as an architect for about a decade. But while I was doing that, I became more and more interested in how buildings and spaces affect our health, and in particular our mental health. And now I work for a company called Ekist. We are a specialist health and wellbeing advisory service. So we basically work with clients from all scales, whether it's wildlife homeowners right up to big developers, basically advising them on how to make their projects healthier. And again, that encompasses the physical side of things and the mental health side of things too.
Fantastic. So first of all, we're going to start with definitions. Wellbeing. Damien, what do you think well-being is? What do you understand by it?
With our clients and the sort of systems that we do, well-being is sort of how we can support their calmness, their mental health within the home, keeping our installations simple, making sure they work, and trying to remove some of the anxiety that people have when they consider audiovisual systems, because AV now is vast. You know, when I started 20-something years ago, I delivered 5-6 tube TVs a day and some VHS recorders, whereas now it's huge what we do. And my understanding of well-being is a space that's calm, that's pleasant, that's exactly what the homeowner's looking to achieve, but without compromising by having to have certain things that they're told they have to have or need to have. So that's where the AV element comes in.
And Susie, what do you understand by well-being?
Well-being has really become a buzzword, hasn't it? We used to just call it being happy. Now it's to the forefront of everyone's mind, and it's a balance between your health, your mental health, and your physical health. And in residential interiors, we are striving to allow our families to live their best lives.
Completely agree with what you said, Susie, that well-being has become a bit of a buzzword, and I think there's a bit of a danger that it's seen as a little bit kind of fluffy or almost kind of, you know, a bit of a hippie thing, a bit of chanting and lighting some joss sticks. But actually for us, it really is about that measurable side of things. It's about enhancing people's quality of life, the quality of their health, and coming back to that word health, I think is really, really important. But basically helping people to live better lives, live longer lives, more pain-free lives, And of course, the mental health side of things too, enhancing social relationships and interactions and making people feel better on a daily basis. So that's why we like to use things like the WELL Building Standard or FitWell, because actually you can measure these things. There's loads of data and information out there available to say, right, this design decision will make someone happier, healthier, it will improve air quality, improve water quality, whatever it might be.
And the WELL Standard, does that apply to residential as much as it applies to workplace design?
Yes, so WELL have actually just launched a new residential standard. It's in the pilot stage at the moment. We're quite lucky. We're working on one of the few UK pilot schemes. So the idea really, it has traditionally been more focused around offices, but they are now looking to expand it into the home and really make sure that everything from a one-off home right up to huge multifamily housing developments can be healthier and can get certified.
Okay. And Susie, from your perspective, it seems very much it's driven by the client and what the client actually wants to achieve to be happy. Is taking the brief then so important in that respect?
Yes, taking the brief is really important. I mean, we all know that a well thought out space creates family harmony, doesn't it? If you don't have storage by your front door and your children are leaving their shoes everywhere, it creates strife, it creates tension. Getting a brief from our clients about how they want to live now and in their future and how they envision themselves in their new spaces is obviously vital.
How do clients articulate it to you, Damien? Did they actually say, I want to be happier, or do they just say, I want a great sound system?
Usually with us, people don't really know what it is they want. So we ask all the questions, and like Susie just said, the brief. We try to get an idea of what they're expecting from each room in the property, how they want to use the room, how they want to live in the room. Have they got any bad experiences at technology, any good experiences that we can address? And then we can start to have the conversations about how we can enhance what it is they're doing within the home. There's a lot of myth that, and some of it I guess is true to an extent, that previously the AV industry has been a case of just saying you need to have this, big speakers and horrible ugly things, whereas now it's so different. It's just changed beyond belief.
I mean, I think that's interesting that technology is part of the solution to creating a happier lifestyle.
Absolutely.
But it's also part of the problem because it makes people anxious and stressful.
Yeah, and manufacturers have really addressed that in recent years. They've really done a lot of homework on how their products can develop and change to enhance the well-being particularly. So, for instance, Lutron, who are here, Snap One, Control 4, Crestron, whoever it might be, the products they're starting to design really address those needs. And they've taken away a lot of the ugly stuff, the boxy type things. So now we have so many more tools to our list that we can use just to enhance what magical work the interior designers do.
And Ben, you talked about evidence. So how can you measure fluffy well-being?
Well, I mean, we can look at some of the things that Susie and Damien have already touched upon. So we do tests on people in cluttered spaces versus tidy spaces. We can test their saliva and look at levels of things like cortisol in the saliva, which is a stress-causing chemical,
okay,
basically. And people will have higher cortisol levels or more irregular cortisol levels in messier spaces. So we know mess directly causes a stress. And similarly, when we talk, Damien talking about things like control and how do we give people control over these systems, again, we know and there's research out there to show that when you give people less control, they report lower happiness scores, lower mental well-being scores. So actually that idea of giving people autonomy and really good control over their environment plays a fundamental role in how happy people feel in spaces.
Wow. So saliva testing is part of the brief, Susie.
Great.
I suppose the point from that is what I think is very important is we need to be taking those lessons. There's so much research going on out there in fields that we often don't engage with as designers. So environmental psychologists are doing all this amazing research. Neuroscientists are coming up with all these fantastic studies. And that doesn't always get communicated back to us as an industry. So I think we, as an industry, we need to engage with that more. And it actually gives us power to go to our clients, particularly bigger commercial clients. And when we're trying to argue the case, but actually we should put in this built-in storage or we should put in this slightly higher spec AV system, we can argue the case and really support it with evidence and data, which is key.
That's really important. So where can designers go? Where can this audience go to actually find out some of these nuggets of information? Because that sounds really useful.
Well, I won't say my books, obviously. I wouldn't do that. But no, actually, the WELL Building Standards website is a really, really good place to start. You can kind of access the entire standard online, whether you're looking at sound or light or air, movement. There's kind of information and a ton of research and studies that you can access via the IWBI's website. So I'd definitely say that's a good start.
Okay. And Susie, what does it mean for you to be designing wellbeing in spaces? Is it important to you as an interior designer that you're doing this?
Of course it's important, yes. You know, everybody wants to feel that in their home, they're an individual, that they're heard, that they feel comfortable and relaxed. And it's our job as designers to create those spaces. And the challenge is, obviously, in a family home, for each member to feel comfortable and relaxed. What feels comfortable for me may not feel comfortable for you. For example, when I get in a car with my husband, he wants the air conditioning really cold. I want it warm. Design has to create, be versatile, so that you can not be bland. So it's not all things to all people, but for that particular client family, you have to really consider all of their wants and wishes.
I suggest you'd agree with that, Ben. It's about empathy, isn't it, with the client?
Yeah, and again, it's about control and choice, giving people a choice of different space types, giving them control over that environment.
Damien, I think it'd be fair to say you come from an industry where they haven't really thought about wellness. Do you think that's changing now?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's changing the way we talk to clients now. So rather than asking them which rooms they want audio in, which rooms do they want to control the heating in and things like that, it's more, how do you want to control it? You know, do you want to have a simple press of a button, or is it automated? Is it with sunrise, sunset? Are you wanting to adjust the temperature of lighting rather than just dimming it up and down? It's changed the whole concept of how we approach a project. You know, rather than just supplying a menu of things that we could do, it's now getting that menu from the client and also the other people on the project to get a real understanding of how we address it.
Since the pandemic, I think we've all become familiar with the term biophilic design. So do you want to just explain that and perhaps why that's becoming much more important?
Yeah, so in a nutshell, biophilia comes from, it's sort of coined in the late 1960s, early 1970s. People like Edward Wilson, who were really big proponents of this idea that we as human beings, we often think of nature as like, it's over there in Hyde Park or outside the M25. Let's go visit it and use it sometimes. But actually, we are animals. We are from nature. We evolved as a part of nature. And therefore, part of that evolution is nature makes us happy. We feel more relaxed in nature. And you can put someone in a space that's got more timber in it, and we see their heart rate will come down by around 3 beats per minute, as an example. We know that. I think the issue with biophilia in the last decade or so is it has become basically just synonymous with people saying, let's just put plants in spaces. And it's so much more than that. It's about things like the movement of sunlight through the day and how shadows change. It's about those irregular movements that are caused by wind moving through a space and all those sort of subtle things. It's not just let's chuck a green wall in and say we've done biophilia.
Yeah. As Susie, you're probably practicing this in the real world as well. So how do you connect with biophilic design?
We have to really think about those fundamental elements from nature. You know, the light, the heat, the darkness, warmth, and really think about how we can transpose those into everyone's family homes. The first question I ask a client is, where's south? You know, where's the sun coming into the building? What are you going to use this room for? Are you thinking that we want cocooning, shaded spaces where you can retreat from the world? Or are we thinking about open, brighter spaces that maybe you're more in the limelight, so to speak? So it's about really considering the light, the warmth of a room. As you say, it's not just about a house plant, although we do use those too.
Of course, yes. Of course. And Damien, how can technology, which is, you know, detached from nature, but how can it connect people with nature?
I walked through the front door of this very building today and I could hear birdsong. And I thought that was incredible. It just immediately made me feel relaxed. It set the scene. It was something that had happened, obviously, before I arrived, but it was kind of automated. It was something that just happened.
Yeah.
It was something that I didn't have to go to a button and press and demand it. It was something that just happened. So we can create that element of automation, which the client doesn't necessarily need to sort of wait for or
yes,
a button for. It happens and it gives that element of surprise where it can just be part of the routine of the day. But at the same time, giving the client the ability to make changes to that if they want to. One of the things we try and avoid is having sort of it locked down and that's the way it's going to be, because that creates anxiety as well. Given the ability to tweak it or change it if they want to, without an engineer going out or us getting involved, is very important to us as well.
And you talked about lighting. So circadian rhythm lighting is also something that's getting a lot of attention. What is that exactly? And can you explain what effect that has?
Yeah, absolutely. So the short version is our bodies are attuned to daylight, and not just the brightness as it changes throughout the day, but also the temperature. When we wake up in the morning, the light is typically very kind of quite a cold blue temperature. And what that does, it basically goes in through the eye, strikes part of our brain that then basically tells us it's morning time, wake up, feel active. It affects our hormone release, even things like when we get hungry, when we need the toilet. All these kind of things are affected by light. So then when we spend all day in an artificial environment with lighting at one solid brightness, one solid temperature, our bodies kind of get a bit confused by that. They don't necessarily know how to respond. And that's often why as well, if you've been working in the office, say, even till 6 or 7 at night, if they're quite bright, cold blue lights, you'll get home and you'll find it really, really hard to switch off. It's because your brain still thinks, oh, it's 9 in the morning. And so, of course, we're going to respond in that way. So circadian lighting is basically mimics that sun's pattern throughout the day. It will start off colder and a bit brighter, and it will get warmer and softer as the day goes on, so that your body is basically responding to that temperature.
And you can program the lighting to do that on your project now, can't you?
Absolutely. We can follow the sun as it moves across the sky. We can do it timed, or it can just be on demand as well.
So. Interesting. Okay, and Susie, I presume a lot of your projects, you've got these, the fashion for big windows, bringing the outdoors in by just creating those amazing views that a lot of your clients have.
So the technology has developed so far with these big glazing systems. It's come from the commercial sector of offices and retail. And now everyone has them in their home when they are building a new extension. They want that inside, outside feeling. Sliding door systems, bifolds, you know, these are prerequisites for most of our projects. And we create the room outside as well as the internal environment. We're not landscape designers at all, but people want these indoor rooms outside. So the technologies have developed that exterior lighting isn't so utilitarian. It's much more residential feeling. The materials, outdoor rugs, outdoor lamps, you know, it really is. There's a whole industry now of this, the outdoor room. And it gives you such a sense of this indoor-outdoor feeling. Everyone feels like they're on holiday in Ibiza.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point. You know, you're just thinking naturally now about the outdoors being just another room.
It's part of it, yeah. I mean, even in the winter months, when you've got these big glazing systems, you don't want to look at a black wall of glass, so you have the exterior lights on.
Ben, as well, you've got to be bringing fresh air in as well, out from the outside to in, to make it feel more connected, haven't you?
Yeah, definitely. And it's something we're talking a lot to interior designers about actually right now, is that indoor air quality. And it's often something that kind of historically has been a little bit overlooked, certainly here in the UK.
Well, it's not visual, is it?
You can't see it. And also in other countries, you know, you go to the States or anywhere like that, and they will tend to have comfort cooling and ventilation in many, many homes. We just don't have that here in the UK because of the climate. So what that tends to mean is we're very reliant on just opening windows to improve air quality, which is fine, but certainly in winter months, you don't want to be opening windows loads. So we need to be more aware as designers of the impact that the materials and furniture we're selecting is having on air quality. And that, thankfully, there is now more of a conversation emerging about VOCs, volatile organic compounds, furniture and paints and carpets and things like that, releasing benzene, formaldehyde, all these nasty chemicals into the air. And of course, we and our children are then breathing those in, especially if we're not ventilating space as well. So again, that's another element we need to be aware of, and certainly sourcing healthier materials and making sure we're specifying those low VOC ones is vital.
And we've talked a little bit about music, but what evidence do you have that music actually has a positive impact on our well-being?
So again, there's a lot of studies out there into this subject, particularly looking at the release of things like serotonin and dopamine. So they're your kind of classic feel-good hormones in the body. And we know that certain types of music absolutely can cause people, it can stimulate the release of more serotonin, more dopamine to make people feel better. And it can even impact people's behavior. So when we look at, for example, tube stations or train stations, they will often play classical music, as certain types of classical music have been shown to reduce incident rates of violence and sort of confrontation. So it can actually relax people, calm people, and make the world a nicer place to live in too.
Okay. How are you delivering music into the home, Damien?
Well, music is just a complete on-demand, massive world of different styles and things like that. It's almost like over-cluttered sort of lists of what you can play. I just want to be able to pick something and it plays. And that's something I want to relay on to my clients as well. Whether that is a playlist that says calm or a playlist that says chill, or it's a genre, so jazz or whatever. So making that process simpler for the client is really, really key. But also addressing how they want to play it. I mean, obviously LPs and vinyl is still a big popular format. So if the client still wants to use the record collection, we can. We don't get many requests for cassettes, but you never know.
Give it a few years.
Yeah, exactly. Just making the process of choosing music simpler.
And what technology integrators do, Susie, I mean, that's part of the story. Music might be coming out of a fantastic speaker system.
But if the surfaces are too hard, then the resonation is just terrible. And the ambience feels cold and hard. We've got a client at the moment that's part of their brief. Can you soften their space? Not only soft furnishings, but it can be like upholstered walls. It's rugs on the floor. It's anything that softens it visually as well as dampening the sound. I mean, we've all been in restaurants where there's no tablecloth or no upholstery and you can't hear yourself think. There are many devices that an interior designer uses for dampening the noise, but also creating comfort and that sense of well-being.
Do you think designers think enough about the environment where people are going to be relaxing?
I'm aware I'm in a room full of designers right now, so of course I'm going to say, yeah. I like to believe most people got into design because they want to create better places for people. Places that make people feel good and make people feel happy. But we've obviously addressed some of the issues and things that can crop up, often not as a result of necessarily even bad design choices, but it can be as a result of things like value engineering, brief changing, client not necessarily knowing what they want. So I think for us, again, as designers, it's just really important that we always have those goals in mind of like, okay, what do we want as targets for the space? I think that can be really important.
I think it's probably that crossover between something that's an experience and something that's quite technical, where designers might feel slightly uncomfortable. I mean, that's probably a conversation you have a lot, isn't it, with designers?
Yeah. It's not bombarding them with technical jargon and things like that. It's just talking on a level playing field. And a lot of our industry at the moment is educating, bringing people up to date with what we can do, hence my heavy involvement with CPDs and things like that. And on manufacturers writing accredited material for BIID and REBA and so on, just to facilitate some basic understanding of what we can do. Because it's changing all the time. You know, I often think to myself, if I was not involved in AV and coming into this as a newcomer, what would the feeling be like? And I know it'd just be, you know, tension and anxiety and whatever. So if we can help interior designers, then that's great.
Sure. I think one other area since the pandemic that's really come to the fore is sleep hygiene. And I read a stat that talked about insomnia being suffered by now 23 million people in this country, which is staggering, absolutely staggering. So how important is it to design spaces to improve that? I mean, is that something that you're consciously now involved with, Susie?
Yes. I mean, all the obvious ones of calm colour palettes and relaxing patterns and soft furnishings, natural timber for the flooring, all of those obvious ones that interior designers have been doing for years. The main point is the technology and how technology has invaded our lives and how there's a balance, isn't there? Lots of technology is amazing, but technology in the bedroom when you're trying to sleep can disturb your natural sleep process. We all know that. One of the first questions that we ask our clients when we're talking about the principal suite is, do you watch television in bed? Do you want a USB port next to your bed? Mostly they do. You have to manage that. And it's about getting that balance between technology, isn't it, Alan?
Yeah, how do you think about that then?
Yeah, so we had, on a recent project, co-living project down in Bermondsey, we made a really simple switch where we basically put a sort of really nicely crafted small timber box in everyone's room. It's got a hole in the back so you can plug your phone in. But the idea is when you're ready to go to sleep, you put your phone in that, you shut the lid, close it, it's plugged in, but then you have a traditional alarm clock in the room as well. So you're not, if you wake up in the night, you look at the clock rather than a screen, which then hits you with all that blue light, instantly activates that circadian system and wakes you right up.
Great solution.
We think it's working quite well at the moment. We've had good feedback from the residents, but I think it's also about being really holistic about it, as Susie was saying, and thinking about that whole sleep environment, but even going beyond that again, and we've touched on daylight. We can create the most perfect sleep environment for someone, but if they're, you know, not getting enough access to daylight during the day, then we know that makes people sleep less.
Yeah.
And even things like acoustic design as well, like noise. Noise is one of the biggest causes of sort of sleep issues and noise disturbances. So particularly when we're looking at kind of multifamily occupancy housing, that's a huge thing to consider. And often it's something that clients, again, want to value engineer out. They're like, oh, we could just remove the odd resilient layer here and there and make the building a bit cheaper, big old cost saving. But actually, when they come a year down the line, 2 years down the line, and they've got residents coming to them complaining every week or so about noise, they wish they'd not removed it in the first place.
So, Damien, technology in the dock again a bit with sleep hygiene. Defend yourself.
Okay. Well, again, we've got so many more tools available to us now. So we're talking about circadian rhythm. For years, we've been able to dim lights. You know, that's nothing new. But the whole idea of circadian rhythm and changing the color temperature is a big, big player for us. So personally, you know, I sometimes, you know, when you turn the light off at night to go to sleep, suddenly you've gone from light in the room to dark. And you're sort of lying there thinking, okay, this is where I'm supposed to fall asleep. If we can gradually over time bring that lighting color and brightness down bit by bit, then you're naturally going to go with it. The same with shades. We don't necessarily have to just bring them right down and that's it. Okay, let's go to sleep. It's a case of bit by bit, as the shades and the lights go down, hopefully you kind of go with it. And the other thing as well is we have quite a few clients who work either nights or they go to bed late afternoon or whatever, where it's still light. So if we can help introduce some facilities where we can adapt the room to darkness gradually through blackout blinds or whatever, music, to enhance their sleep cycle so that when they do wake up at 2-3 in the morning or whatever, they've had a decent sleep, they've not battled with trying to get to sleep, then that's a really great thing for us. So trying to help people to sleep, it's not something we've done a lot of in the past, but thanks to some of the brands that are around that we work with, it's a big, big topic of ours at the moment.
And physical and mental health, we talked about that at the outset. And I read that by 2050, 1 in 4 people living here are going to be over 65, which, again, is quite a staggering figure to get your head around. And I think all of us here probably are thinking about living where we are now and trying to live there for as long as possible without having to go into care homes. Or we may have parents who are already facing those decisions. So can design help in those respects, and what trends are you seeing?
Yeah, definitely. I think even if we look at building regs and the way that the building regs have changed in the last 20 years, it's much more geared now towards adaptable homes and homes that we can keep using, as you say, as we get older, maybe as mobility deteriorates. And of course, there's, you know, solutions to get you up the stairs and all those kinds of things as well. But I think as well, we need to just talk about, actually, we kind of are obsessed in not just this country, but kind of a lot of the world with lifespan and trying to live for as long as we possibly can. But actually, I'm much more interested in that gap between when does our quality of life become bad and then how much longer do we live after that. And, you know, often you see people, unfortunately, quality of life really deteriorating, say, in the mid to late 70s, and then they may live another 15 years. Can we close that gap and say, actually, our quality of life goes on much, much longer rather than necessarily just the length? And that's where buildings can, again, play a really important role. So can we design buildings that encourage people to be more active? Maybe workplaces that encourage us to take the stairs rather than take the lifts. Can we design later living accommodations, say, that encourages us to be more social? Because we know when people have closer social connections, when they have more friends, then they tend to live longer, they tend to have longer quality of life for longer, they eat better. So there's all these things, again, we can do through design moves to encourage those social interactions that actually do really then help people to keep living in their homes for much longer.
Susie, what are you doing in that respect?
So we are trying to future-proof our projects as well, so that the family home is looking for 10 years in the future, whether it's the child that becomes the teenager or whether it's the retiree that's looking for when they become more elderly. We are trying to think in advance because it's a big investment that they're making into their home. So that's always a part of our brief. And I find that when you're looking at like the over 60s, they are not frightened of technology. They are not frightened of design. I'm nearly there. They they want to embrace it. Gone are the days of just chintz will do. They may be downsizing, but those smaller homes will be perfectly designed, perfectly formed. My dad is 86, although he can't use a mobile phone. He does have Alexa.
Really?
Alexa enhances his life. You know, he will read the paper, find all the latest artists on there, write them down and ask Alexa to play them. Recently, I walked in and Stormzy was playing. So, you know, just in a very basic way, technology can enhance life in the older generation.
Wow. And practical applications from your side, Damien?
Yeah, I mean, voice control is a big one for us. One of the things that we get requested a lot is the remote observation for loved ones. We noticed this was particularly during COVID, where people want to be able to know that their loved ones are okay through logging of sensors that's picked up movement, or knowing that the windows are closed at night or the doors shut or whatever, giving peace of mind to not only the elderly but also the relatives.
So monitoring rather than complete Big Brother territory.
Well, that was kind of in the back of my mind. Yeah, it's removing that Big Brother thing and making sure it's safe and secure as well, that it can't be hacked or dad can be watched by someone else, that it's completely tied in and it's bespoke to what they need. The other thing as well is just making sure that whatever we put in is tasteful and relevant to what the client needs. So reducing clutter. Even my parents, you know, they're mid to late 60s now, they still have sort of four or five remote controls on the table and they're trying to find the right one or whatever. So if we can bring something in that's just one remote that we know is simple and easy to use and hasn't got millions of buttons, then that's great. That gives us a great feeling that they can use it with ease.
I think a business that could recycle remote controls would be incredibly valuable going forwards. Exactly. Excellent. Okay, and we talked earlier about ethical sourcing of products. What do you see as the crossover between health and well-being and sustainable and ethical sourcing?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think it's an area where people are still getting confused quite a lot. I know before I started learning about this subject, it was something I maybe wasn't that educated in. And there's a bit of an assumption that if something is sustainable, it's good, i.e. good for the planet, then it's also healthy and good for humans. But actually, loads of stuff now, a big trend is make stuff out of recycled sea plastic, for example. And yeah, that's great. We're getting plastic out of the ocean. But at the same time, then maybe our children are like rolling around on all these plastic materials, getting covered in microplastics, which when you look at the stats in terms of prevalence of microplastics in our blood, in all of our body cells, it's really quite scary. So I think we just need to look at it with a little bit more of an inquisitive eye and just interrogate it a little bit further. Of course, there are lots of big overlaps, some things that are really good for the planet, sort of circular economy, whether it's kind of natural materials, things like that, they can be really good for the planet and also good for us as humans too. But it's just a case of doing that research and just making sure you understand the sustainability side and the human health side. And there's websites like Origin, which are really good for that sort of thing. So you can access loads of basically health certified materials out there. It might be Green Guard certified or Declare label, those sorts of things. They're definitely worth checking out.
Do you agree with that, Susie, that approach?
Yes, definitely. In our experience, there's like the macro view and then the micro view. So there's a macro view for our studio, for example. We've installed an air source heat pump, solar thermal, photovoltaic cells to obviously create a level of comfort in our studio for our design team. Is that well-being? Well, yes it is. It also gives you a feeling that you're not burning a fossil fuel, and it also saves money at the end of the day. But on a micro level, we encourage our clients not to chuck everything away and start
of course,
again.
Yeah. And technology can help with energy management, certainly, can't it?
Yeah, there's two aspects of sustainability from our point of view. One is obviously turning things off when they're not being used. So I've got a 7 and a 3-year-old. I'm always finding the TV still on, the lights on, things like that, and also the heating roaring when I get home and things like that. So if we can help the planet by having sensors or timers or whatever it needs to be to monitor that usage and keep the energy levels down, then that's a really good thing. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that a lot of our support that we provide is done remotely. So we don't need to get in a van and travel and burn diesel. So with remote monitoring, so for instance, there's a platform called Oversee, which Snap One have, where we can log in and see something that's offline. We can talk people through it. And also manufacturers are much more aware of recycling materials. So rather than just throwing things away that don't work anymore, they recycle the components, they recycle the casing and things like that. A lot of our products are low power and PoE, power over Ethernet. So we don't have big power supplies that need to be on sucking energy out of the earth. So again, more and more tools available to us that are allowing us to help do our bit with the planet.
Excellent. Well, thank you all. Let's have a round of applause for everybody here.